Okay, get this. You're serving life, right? A sentence handed down decades ago, and then boom, a Supreme Court ruling comes along and it like throws everything up in the air. It could give you a shot at freedom, but hold on. Then the governor steps in, total game changer. Sounds like a legal thriller, right?
It does.
Well, this is State v. Ragland, a real-life legal drama, and it comes out of Iowa. And that's why we're diving deep into juvenile sentencing, executive power, and what life without parole really even means.
Yeah, and what makes the State v. Ragland case so interesting is it's not just about one man's fate, right? It's like a tiny version of the way we think about juvenile justice, like legally and as a society. Like it forces us to deal with like really complicated questions, you know, about how much we can punish, the potential for rehab, and that tricky balance between different parts of the government, like the branches.
Totally. So we've got these excerpts from legal analyses, case summaries, and we're ready to like break down the arguments and unpack what makes this decision so important, right?
Yeah.
So by the end of this deep dive, you'll get not only the specific facts, but also how the Iowa Supreme Court's ruling could change, like reshape similar cases all over the country. And we'll leave you thinking about some pretty big questions about justice and second chances, right?
Right. I think what you'll find really interesting is how this case makes us look past the actual words of the law, you know, and consider the real-world impact of these sentencing decisions, like how it hits these young offenders. It's a stark reminder that the legal system is about people's lives, not just abstract principles.
For sure. So rewind back to 1986. That's where our story begins. 17-year-old Jeffrey Ragland, he gets involved in a fight, and it ends tragically. You know, someone dies. And he is convicted under the felony murder rule. Now, for those who aren't familiar with that, that means he didn't directly cause the death, but he participated in a felony that led to it.
Yeah, that difference, that's crucial. It speaks to like how responsible he was, you know? And that felony murder rule can be controversial, especially with juveniles, because it makes you wonder if their involvement may be driven by being impulsive or peer pressure. You know, should that equal the same punishment as someone who like intentionally caused the death?
That's a great point.
Yeah.
And back in 86, Iowa law didn't mess around. The sentence for this type of conviction, mandatory life without parole,
Yeah.
no exceptions, not even for a 17-year-old.
Yeah, and this really harsh sentencing, it wasn't just Iowa back then. The 80s and early 90s, the whole country was in this tough on crime phase. Lots of states doing mandatory minimums, getting rid of parole for serious crimes. The thinking was, hit them hard, deter crime, and keep the public safe. But as we'll see, this approach had big consequences, especially for young offenders.
Makes sense. So Ragland starts serving this, was basically a life sentence.
Yeah.
Now fast forward to 2012, and there's this landmark Supreme Court ruling that changes everything. Miller v. Alabama comes in, and the court just declares mandatory life without parole for juveniles unconstitutional, right? It violates the Eighth Amendment, the ban on cruel and unusual punishment. So what's the logic behind this groundbreaking decision?
Well, the Miller decision, it shows how we're getting better at understanding, you know, how adolescent brains develop both scientifically and as a society. The court recognized that kids are fundamentally different from adults, you know, more impulsive, less able to think about long-term consequences, and they have a greater capacity for rehabilitation, you know, to change. Essentially, the court said sentencing a kid to die in prison without thinking about their situation or potential to change, that's inherently cruel and unusual.
It's like the legal system finally caught up to what scientists have been saying for ages. You know, developmental psychologists, neuroscientists, children aren't mini adults. Their brains are still being built, right? And that has a huge impact on how we hold them accountable for their actions.
Exactly. Miller v. Alabama, that wasn't just some legal victory. It represents this big shift in how we see youth and what juvenile justice is even for. It started to move away from just punishing and more towards a nuanced approach, acknowledging the possibility of rehab and second chances.
I love that. So now we've got Miller on the books. Where does that leave Ragland, right? He was sentenced under a law that's now unconstitutional.
Well, the Iowa Supreme Court, following Miller, ordered a resentencing hearing for Ragland. Seems pretty straightforward, right? Give him a chance to have his case looked at again with this new understanding of juvenile justice. But hold on, there's a twist. Before they could even have the resentencing hearing, then Governor Terry Branstad stepped in and commuted Ragland's sentence.
Wait, commuted? Does that mean he was set free?
Not quite. Branstad changed it to life with the possibility of parole, but here's the catch, only after 60 years. This move, well, it really messed with the legal process, you know, created this separation of powers dilemma. Did the governor's commutation actually fulfill the requirements of Miller, Or did it just sidestep the need for a proper resentencing hearing, you know, where they could really look at Ragland's situation and his potential for rehabilitation?
So we've got this head-to-head between the judiciary, who are about to revisit the sentence, and the executive branch, using its clemency power. I mean, it's crazy how this seemingly simple case suddenly becomes a constitutional showdown, you know?
Absolutely. This clash, it goes straight to the heart of some fundamental questions about our government, you know? Like, what can the executive branch really do when it comes to sentencing? Can a governor basically overrule a court, especially when that court's decision is based on a Supreme Court ruling?
Right, it begs the question. And it's a situation, well, ripe for debate. And that's exactly what happened, right? Ragland's lawyers, they argued that the governor's commutation didn't cut it. They said he was denied a super important right, an individualized hearing where his youth and potential for rehab could be, like, front and center in the judge's decision.
Right. And this is where things get really interesting from a legal point of view. They argued that, sure, on the surface, the governor's commutation looked like it gave a way out eventually, but really, it was basically the same as life without parole.
Okay, so break that down for us. What does functional equivalence mean in this context?
So the Iowa Supreme Court, in this move that shook the legal world, agreed with Ragland. They came up with this idea of functional equivalence, basically saying courts can't just look at what a sentence is called. They have to look at its real impact.
So even though Ragland technically could get parole after 60 years, the court saw it as basically a life sentence. Because let's be real, he'd be 77 years old by then.
Exactly. The court argued that for a juvenile, a sentence with no real hope of release during their life, that doesn't take into account their unique situation and the potential for rehabilitation that Miller focused on.
This functional equivalence thing feels like a total game changer. It makes courts look beyond just the words of a sentence and really wrestle with the human consequences, especially for young offenders, you know?
You got it. It raises the bar for what's constitutional when sentencing juveniles. States can't just try to get around Miller with tricky wording. They have to show that the sentence really gives a real chance for release.
And the ripple effects of this decision, they go way beyond Iowa, right? The fact that Miller v. Alabama applies retroactively, that means this case could impact tons of juvenile cases across the country, even the ones that seemed final. But we're just getting started here. Stay tuned as we continue our deep dive into State v. Ragland. Welcome back to our deep dive into State v. Ragland.
Okay.
We left off talking about how the Iowa Supreme Court's ruling brought in this concept of functional equivalence. It basically forces courts to think about the actual real-world impact of a sentence, not just like what it's technically called. It's a wild twist in this whole legal story. What are your thoughts on what this functional equivalence idea means?
Well, you see, this idea of functional equivalence, it's really important. It doesn't just look at how long a sentence is, right? It makes courts really grapple with what a sentence truly means for a juvenile, like considering their age, their potential for rehabilitation, and the chance they might actually build a life outside prison.
It feels like it could have a massive impact, right, on how we approach juvenile sentencing across the country, especially with Miller v. Alabama applying retroactively.
Absolutely. We're already seeing a wave of cases challenging these long juvenile sentences that everyone thought were final. Lawyers, now they have this functional equivalence argument. They're pushing courts to reevaluate if these sentences really give a meaningful chance for release. It's changing the legal world in a big way.
It sounds like a huge job for the judicial system, revisiting all these cases. What are some of the biggest challenges they'll probably face?
Well, one of the biggest is figuring out what exactly is a meaningful opportunity for release. There's no clear rule, you know, no magic number of years that makes it automatically constitutional. It has to be a case-by-case thing, looking at the crime, the offender situation, and proof of rehabilitation.
Yeah, I bet that creates a lot of gray areas for judges, right?
Yeah.
It's not just about the number of years on a sentence anymore.
You got it. There's a lot of judgment involved, which also means there could be inconsistency in how these cases are decided. Different judges might understand meaningful opportunity differently, you know, leading to different outcomes depending on where you are. It's complicated, and the law is still changing.
Right. It's not black and white.
Yeah.
But it also brings up some deep ethical and philosophical questions, right? Like, how long is too long to sentence a juvenile? Where do we draw the line between punishment and, like, the possibility of redemption?
Those are questions for society as a whole to figure out. The Ragland case started this bigger conversation about what's the point of juvenile justice even, you know? Is it just about revenge? Or should it be more about rehabilitation, giving young people a chance to turn their lives around?
Yeah, it does feel like a fundamental shift in how we see juvenile justice. We're moving away from that adult crime, adult time mindset. And finally, recognizing that young people, even the ones who commit serious crimes, have the potential to change, right?
Yeah, that's a key takeaway here. We're starting to understand that adolescent brains are still developing, that young people are more likely to do impulsive things and be influenced by peer pressure, and that they can generally rehabilitate better than adults.
And that shift, we're seeing it not just in legal decisions like Raglan, but also in policy discussions all over the country, right?
Exactly. There's this movement to reform how we sentence juveniles, move away from those super long sentences that don't offer much hope of release. We're seeing more emphasis on alternatives to prison, you know, programs focused on rehabilitation and getting back into society.
So it's not just about fixing past mistakes, but also preventing new ones by creating a system that really understands the needs and potential of young offenders, right?
I think that's the key. If we really believe in second chances, we have to build a system that allows for them, especially for young people who messed up, but who can learn, grow, and become productive members of society.
Which takes us back to the heart of the Raglan case, that clash between the executive and judicial branches. The governor's commutation, it raised some serious flags about separation of powers. And if the executive branch can basically overrule a court's decision on a sentence.
The concurring opinions in Raglan, they really show this tension. Some justices were worried that what the governor did could set a bad precedent, potentially undermining the court's job of protecting constitutional rights.
Right. So it raises the question, is the governor's clemency power absolute, or are there limits, especially with sentences that are considered unconstitutional?
That's a debate that'll probably keep going as more cases like Raglan go through the courts. There's no easy answer, but it highlights the balance of power in our government and how important it is that each branch respects what the others do.
And this debate goes beyond the law, right? It touches on broader societal questions about what a just and fair system of punishment should be. What's the role of clemency? How do we balance accountability with the possibility of redemption?
It's complex, no easy answers. The Raglan case made us face these questions head on, and the conversation's not over yet.
We've definitely covered a lot in this deep dive, but there's still more to unpack. Stick with us as we wrap things up and explore some final thoughts on the lasting impact of State v. Raglan. So we've been through the ups and downs of State v. Raglan, right? From a teenage fight to a life sentence, a major Supreme Court ruling, a governor stepping in, and a state Supreme Court trying to figure out what justice really means for young offenders. It's been like a wild ride. What sticks out to you as the most important takeaway from this whole case?
You know, for me, it's that huge shift in how we're thinking about juvenile justice. State v. Raglan is not just a case, right? It shows how society is changing, how we're dealing with those harsh punishments from the past, and how we're starting to realize that young people, even the ones who make big mistakes, deserve a chance at redemption.
Yeah, like we're finally saying a kid's life shouldn't be over because of one thing they did, no matter how serious. And punishment, especially for young offenders, should be about more than just getting even, right?
Exactly. The Raglan case makes us ask, what's the real purpose of our justice system? Is it all about punishment, or is it also about rehabilitation? About giving people, especially young people, a real shot at learning, growing, and becoming good citizens again?
Those are tough questions. There's no easy answer. But Raglan has made us face these questions. It sparked this conversation about how we balance accountability with compassion. Justice with second chances, right?
And that conversation goes way beyond just the legal stuff. It's about our values as a society, you know, how we see young people, and if we believe people can change.
This case has been like a real learning experience, even for someone like me who loves legal stuff. So what are some practical takeaways from Raglan for lawyers and law students? You know, what should they be paying attention to?
Well, Raglan is a wake-up call for anyone working in juvenile justice. It shows this area of law is changing fast, and old ways of thinking don't always apply anymore.
So it's not enough to just know the big cases, right? You got to understand the details, the arguments, and how things could change.
Exactly. Lawyers need to be ready to challenge sentences that don't fit with the Miller framework, even in cases that seemed closed. They got to get this functional equivalence concept, know how to use it, and be aware of the changing standards for what makes a meaningful opportunity for release, you know?
Sounds like Raglan has opened up a whole new legal battlefield, with cases still going on and maybe even more heading to the Supreme Court.
Most likely. We'll probably keep debating how much power the executive branch has in sentencing, how far this functional equivalence idea goes, and what exactly courts should consider when they're looking at juvenile sentences. It's fascinating to watch. And what happens in these future cases could have a big impact on juvenile justice, you know?
Definitely. So as we wrap up this deep dive, what's one thing you want our listeners to think about? Something to ponder as they explore this complicated and ever-changing issue?
Well, here's a thought. If a sentence, even one with parole, basically takes away any real chance of freedom for a young person, can we really say it's just? This question, it goes beyond the legal technicalities. It makes us look at our values, at whether we believe in redemption.
Those are powerful words. State v. Ragland, it's a case that'll keep people talking and will shape the legal world for years to come. It reminds us that seeking justice is a journey, not a destination, right? It needs to get us to keep thinking, keep adapting, and keep facing those tough questions. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive. Until next time, keep learning, keep asking questions, and keep diving deep.